The reality for many of you is that investment properties where you live have become absolutely unaffordable. The good news is that there are many cities with affordable properties and many of those under 100K. If you're someone who's ready to buy your first out-of-state property in the next 4 months, then I encourage you to check out my free training that'll break down the process and show you exactly what it takes to invest out of state. I purchased properties out of state and it's changed my life. The same is possible for you. You simply need the right information. My free training will help you take that next step towards buying your first out-of-state property. You can watch the training right now at outofstatemoney.com, or you can click the link in the description of this episode. Again, you can find it at outofstatemoney.com, or you can click the link in the description of this episode.
Excuse me, may I talk to you for a second?
Yes. This is the Black Real Estate Dialogue, and the purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast, episode 170. A few quick announcements before we jump into this. So if you haven't already, pause this episode, take a moment to leave a 5-star rating and review. Won't take you any more than 30 seconds, and it actually helps us out a lot. It helps us get in front of more people and expose this information all over the world. Y'all know this is important, so do me a favor, leave that 5-star rating and review. If you do leave a 5-star rating and review, send me an email. My email is in the show notes, and I'll reply back with a free training on how to find and analyze properties. So if you are somebody just starting out, you want to learn how you should look for properties, some of the numbers to run, and all those things, definitely leave that 5-star rating and review and shoot me an email. I actually want to read a review that we got recently, and it says, "Absolutely amazing podcast. I love this podcast and tune in every chance I get. It is very informative and educational. I honestly look forward to using the information and applying it in real life and hopefully being able to share my journey as I begin this journey in real estate." And that's from Sergeant Sir. Thank you. Really appreciate you. If you haven't already, shoot me an email and I'll get you that training. I'm so excited about this interview with Brandon Rule. Brandon has been doing amazing things within the real estate development space and has done over $100 million in real estate development. So we're going to talk about a whole bunch of amazing things. And shout out to Meredith for helping to set this interview up. We did this interview while I was in New Orleans at Black Real Estate Week. And so without further ado, let's get into it.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast. If you're on YouTube, make sure you like, make sure you share, subscribe. If you're on audio, leave us a 5-star rating and review and subscribe, of course. Looking forward to hearing from you. We're live from New Orleans. I'm excited about this interview today. Here with me, I have Brandon Rule. Brandon, appreciate you making the time, man.
Of course. How are you feeling? Thanks for the invite. Pretty good. I'm excited.
Definitely, definitely. So let's jump right in. So for people who may not know who you are, just talk about who you are and what you do in the space.
I am Brandon Rule, a commercial real estate developer, community developer. Really just a guy here to leave legacy and impact at the end of the day. Like, that's my purpose. That's what I'm doing. Started off on my development journey in real estate, specializing on affordable housing. It's now transitioned. I will always do that, but I'm also doing some market rate stuff, master planning things, and really going to different geographic areas as well. Originally from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, born in LA, moved there when I was 5, was in an earthquake, and then expanded to DC about 6 or so years ago, got a place in Atlanta about 1.5 years ago. So I go between DC primarily, Milwaukee and Atlanta at the moment, but I'll probably go more full-time in Atlanta soon and then spend some of my time in DC, Milwaukee.
Love it, love it. Love it, man. So you mentioned affordable housing. So what got you into affordable housing?
Originally, I thought, anyone that doesn't know my story, I thought I was going to be a doctor for a while. My whole goal was to, like, give back and just help people. And when I went to college, classes didn't work out the way that I thought they would, and I had to shift and pivot. My dad told me at a very young age, he was like, "My dad told me I had to be better than you. Than him, so you have to be better than me." Yeah. So I equated that to, like, oh, he's an x-ray tech. I want to be a doctor. That makes me better, as if, like, that's what makes a man. Yeah. Obviously, your profession doesn't make a man.
Yeah.
But me being young, that's why I had that desire. My mom, on the other hand, she was always in the community. She was the executive, the president of the neighborhood association that we grew up in. So she was a volunteer there, giving back, served, you know, pretty much 20 years. She was doing community work. So when I was going through school, started studying sociology and, you know, people and for like understanding how we fit within society. And I also started studying economics, money, capitalism, et cetera. So I'm like, even while I wanted to be a doctor, I knew I wanted to do real estate on the side. Went through a program, exposed me to commercial real estate. And that's when I was like, oh, I want to do that. So to bring it all full circle, really helping people, I could do it through commercial real estate and development in particular, having autonomy in my time, and then creating wealth for myself, family, friends, et cetera. That's why I wanted to do commercial real estate development.
Yeah.
In Milwaukee, it's really difficult to do anything outside of really affordable housing because there's not enough income. The rents aren't high enough to be able to do significant market rate construction, especially around this time coming out of the 08. It just wasn't there. So I'm looking at my community again, looking at my mom. It's like, okay, my dad was a doctor, but my mom actually is giving back too. How do I do community development in a way that utilizes the skill sets that I'm learning through this commercial real estate development stuff? I'm like, cool. Let me look into affordable housing. Started to learn about the low-income housing tax credit and how it's financing most of the affordability in the country right now from a new construction perspective. And I just was laser focused on trying to figure that out. So I went to a bunch of conferences, met with a bunch of people, had a bunch of conversations just like this.
Yeah.
Watched YouTube University. It wasn't as robust, you know, 10, 15 years ago like it is today, but I was picking up gems from everywhere. And after about 6 years, I got my first development, which was a 60-unit low-income housing tax credit project, right outside of the area that my mom was running. I was raised on 26. The first one was on 7.
Wow.
And I would pass this site every day going to high school. So it was a really cool thing to, like, preserve affordability in this area because the Bucks, they had just, I think, been acquired. They were planning for a new arena. There was a ton of gentrification going on in this area already because it was so close to downtown. I wanted the people that I grew up with and around there to still be able to afford the areas in which we live. So I ended up doing that. It was a difficult process, but we got it done. And then I actually did an 89-unit, 6 blocks even closer to where I was raised, affordable housing development there as well. So between the two, started off 149 units, quality affordable housing, right in my backyard. And that's how I wanted to get into commercial real estate.
Love it. So that's just incredible impact. So take me back to that moment when you got the first one up, you know, it's in your community, in your hometown. Like, what was that feeling like? Because you mentioned, you know, 6 years or so, you're just grinding, learning, trying to figure it out. And then you go through all the steps and boom, it's done.
Yes. I wouldn't describe it as a boom. It's done, but it was like a yes. Finally. It was more of a finally than a boom. But
yeah,
I mean, it was surreal. I try not to even take moments like this for granted, even now that I have more and more developments and more opportunities. Like, I always try to think about how I felt when that specific moment. So we did a groundbreaking ceremony, and it was amazing, man. My friends came out. My family was there. I gave a speech to everyone, and I talked about how it really took a village. If you look up some of the previous articles that was written about that development, it said it was a lasagna of partners. I had 9 different financial sources in that one capital stack, that one deal.
Wow.
So having the resilience to be able to, like, yes, this deal died, but I'm going to keep fighting. It died, but I'm going to keep fighting. I'm going to keep fighting. And then finally getting to a point where it's like, oh, it's here. It introduced me to development for sure, but it was gratifying, to say the least, to see my family being able to, like, hey, this is a physical manifestation of my thoughts, my dreams, my actions, and I'm able to do this good for people. Seeing them embrace me in that way, my mother, my father, my grandma was there, cousins, best friends, like, it was amazing. I do have one story about that day that I'll never forget, though. That is actually helped even frame what I'm doing beyond this. there was a guy, we were doing site visits, so we had three residents with their homes open for us. And there was one guy in particular, he was one of our 30% units. I think it was, you know, their rent is probably 300 or so bucks at the time, a little under 400. And we go, one of our equity investors asked him, he said, hey, you know, how do you like it? He was like, man, I love it. You know, stainless steel appliances, like, it's super nice. This is everything that I could have wished for. That's the answer that I expected. Like, okay, cool. Like, it felt good to do that for and on behalf of people like him. And then he said, but honestly, the biggest thing that I love the most about it is that I can get my meds now. I'm like, what do you mean by that? And he was like, man, you know, a few months ago, I was living right in Tent City, right under the bridge, right there. Mm-hmm. And what most people don't realize is when you're homeless, you don't have access to healthcare or medicine because you don't have a physical address. And I was like, whoa. So now, not only did he have a place where, you know, quality place to live, super nice. I think he's still there to this day. I got to double check. I don't want to misquote, but he was recently. He also can have access to the things that he needs most to be able to have his most sustainable life. So that was interesting for me. I didn't know that that would happen, but all of that in that day just was extremely gratifying.
Yeah, man, that's special. And I think that's the power of real estate. You know, a lot of people look at investors and developers like these greedy, money-hungry people. I'm sure some are, but, you know, there's people like you, there's people out there who, I mean, obviously you're in business to make money, but, you know, you're literally transforming lives. Like, people can live with dignity, you know, whereas before it was probably run down for shacks and stuff like that. So I think that's something important for people to think about, as you know, especially if they want to get into this space.
Couldn't agree more, man. And in this building, there was zero displacement. It was an old industrial building that was only like 25 or 30% used.
Wow.
Tore that down. They relocated their facility. And then we built new quality apartments that were very much so like market rate housing. It's just we have an affordability level. Now, to the point that you just made about making money, yes, we all want to make money. This deal, as sexy as it sounds, it was a $12.5 million deal. And when I closed on this deal, late 2018, pretty much 9 years into my development journey, I received a $6,000 check. So as much as it looks sexy, I had to forego a lot in order to get that done just so the gentleman can live there. And a huge part of that was the income I made. My paid developer fee on that deal was $30,000 total. I have a deferred fee that may come, you know, at a significantly later date. But how many people would do 9 years worth of work and only make $30,000? Well, really six. I didn't make the other 24 until another 2 years after that. So that's a question that, you know, I hope the audience asks themselves when they're like, oh, yeah, I want to do this big fun development stuff. That's hopefully a one-off for anyone that's watching this and you're trying to get into the space. But it is a reality and something you got to be aware of when you get into it.
Yeah, definitely. So I want to talk about that a little bit more because, to your point, you know, sometimes you got to start a little bit smaller as far as the money you're taking in just so you can gain the experience to kind of, I mean, you've gone on to do amazing things since then. Was it difficult for you to, you know, at the point when you realize I'm not really going to get much out of this, was it difficult for you to proceed or to feel like, you know, in the long term, you can make it profitable and continue to grow?
For that deal, I'd say it was difficult to swallow the reality that was setting in, right? When I first was putting my numbers together, it was like a $10 million deal. Thinking my developer fee was going to be $1.2 million. I thought that I would have a partner that would have a minority stake in that, and I'm going to be a millionaire. You know, that was the original thought. But over the course of the next three and a half years, when I got the deal done, reality set in, right? So I think, yes, over that period of time from 2016 to 19, let's just say, 2015 to 19, there were some tough moments of accepting the reality of the few hundred thousand or $1 million that I thought I would make is now going to be pretty much nothing. I mean, literally $6,000. And we get paid last as developers, mm-hmm. right? Like, if at all at times. And it was tough. But what I knew with my future deals, I wouldn't do the same things that I did here. Mm-hmm. I also knew that the resilience and character that I was building by going through that process was going to help me well beyond that period of time. And frankly, I was coming from little to nothing from a monetary perspective anyway. So it's like, okay, I went from nothing to nothing. What's the difference? Like, at least I gained the knowledge and I'm able to use that to catapult and springboard into other things later. So it was difficult during the moment, but I always had my eyes set on the bigger picture. So it never really fazed me too much.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad you explained that because, you know, I appreciate the transparency because I want people to know, like, you can't give up, right? Like, you can't give up on the first deal if it doesn't go as planned. You got to keep going, you know, it's with the compound interest, right? Like, you keep building, keep getting better, taking the lessons, and I mean, who knows what could happen?
Absolutely. Yeah, you can't. I think one of the things that I'll add to that statement of not giving up is just you also know when to give up. Because OG of mine, mentor, Egbert Perry, one of the best OG mentor of mine, Egbert Perry, he tells me a couple things. One is one of the best deals you can ever do is the one you didn't. Mm-hmm. So that's a real thing. Like, every deal isn't a slam dunk deal. And another thing is he says you can die from indigestion. So as much as I'm looking at, like, potential opportunities and I can do this and I can do that and I can do this and, yes, I'm in articles and interviews like this and papers and I get a lot of notoriety and a lot of opportunity, the reality is I can't do it all, you know, because literally you can die of indigestion when you're trying to eat all of this and your body doesn't process it all. You're killing yourself, quite literally. So from a figurative perspective on the business side, I think there's two ends of the spectrum.
Yeah.
One on the front end where it's like, hey, yes, I'm trying and I should not give up. You have to start to learn when the giving up for that specific deal should happen.
Yeah.
And then on the other side where it's like you have so many things going on, you should also know when to turn off. So not give up, but turn off certain things.
Yeah.
And they say don't fall in love with a deal. Never give up on the dream.
Yeah.
Even if you have to take a different alternative route on the process.
Definitely. So let's talk about low income tax credits. I don't think we've had anybody on the show dive into that at all. So could you explain a bit about just how that works and how it can be advantageous for developers?
Yeah, so it's Section 42 of the IRS code is what it is. Mm-hmm. And it is low income housing tax credit. So what they did in the, you know, 30s, HUD had these 100% affordable, really low-income projects. We know them as projects today, right?
Right.
As they were building them, they concentrated 200, 300, 500,000 people into these very small clusters, frankly. There had been extremely low-income targets, so whenever you're in that HUD, Section 8, et cetera, it's 30% AMI or lower. Mm-hmm. And when you concentrate all of those people together, but any concentration of people together that are impoverished or in poverty, you will get a ghetto. It just so happened to, like, intentionally, you know, structure those around Black people across the country. But that aside, just explaining Section 8 and what was the projects, Cabrini Green, Berry Farms, Bowen Homes, depending on where you are in the country, that is not what the Section 42 is. It completely changed that thought process of extremely low-income individuals being concentrated. Mm-hmm. What Section 42 is a new way to develop housing. And what they do is say, hey, let's create a tax credit. So the federal government says each state has X amount of population. We're going to allocate this pie of tax credits based upon your population.
Gotcha.
So each state gets their percentage in a pro rata basis. And then the state says, okay, we're going to create a qualified allocation plan, which is a very specific set of rules that govern their tax credit program.
Right.
And a state may say, hey, we're focused on veterans, or we're focused on people with disabilities, or we're focused on homelessness. Another state may say, we're focused on rural communities. Yeah. It depends on what their priorities are, but typically every 2 years they create a new qualified allocation plan. Within that, you typically see a scoring sheet that'll tell you pretty much what the priorities of that state is, right? Because they're going to score their priorities to be a little higher.
Right.
And developers have the opportunity to go in, identify sites, whether it be publicly owned land or private owned land, and submit to the states that have these low-income housing tax credits. What it does is it offsets the cost of your development. Mm-hmm. If you have, let's just say, where are we? New Orleans. Yeah. We're in New Orleans right now. Right up the street, there may be a one-bedroom that can rent for $2,000. Mm-hmm. About 10 minutes from here, I'm sure there's a two-bedroom that can only rent for $1,000.
Yeah.
The people that will pay $2,000 aren't willing to live in this area right now. The cost to build these developments, whether it's in this place of $2,000 or that place of $1,000, are the exact same.
Right.
So what happens? This gets built and this doesn't. It's a pretty simple equation.
Yeah. You know,
we're a capitalistic society. We only are doing things that make money and make sense. So the federal government's like, hey, okay, let's create a tool to incentivize affordability in areas, incentivize development and affordability in certain areas. So that's what this Section 42 tool is. So you create this tax credit. Developers come, put together their program. They say, okay, $2,000, let's say it's a $10 million deal, $2,000 a month when you do all of your back of the envelope stuff. The value of this property is $10 million. If you do the same exact thing for this $1,000, the value of this property is $5 million.
Right.
The rent is half, the value is half. Let's just keep it simple. So the cost to build this is $10 million, and the cost to build that is $10 million. This one will get built, this one will not. But the tax credit that they create, it's an annual tax credit for 10 years that people can realize. So let's just say you were developing this and you had a $5 million gap, you needed $5 million here. Mm-hmm. If you submit it for tax credits, you may request $500,000 worth of tax credits in this year. You get it for 10 years. So five times the 10, that's the 5 million.
Right.
There's then a marketplace of banks and institutions that are purchasing tax credits because their taxable liability is too high. They want to lower it. So they may give you a dollar today in exchange for this tax credit over the next 10 years.
Wow.
You then take your dollar that you got from them. So here's $5 million. Well, I'm the investor, you're the developer. You're giving me the tax credit of $5 million over this 10 years. I'm giving you an upfront payment of $5 million today so you can now build this. So that's what the tax credit does.
Wow.
So your debt is only $5 million because it's rent restricted, the income restricted. But you got a $5 million subsidy from the federal government that is funded by an institution, and now you can build something that wasn't able to get built before. And in order to do that, the program outlines AMI levels of 30%, 50%, 60% is typically the target. Anything above that has not historically been affordable housing, but now you can go up to 80 for certain things. Me, I focused on mixed income, so I try to do 30, 50, 60, 80, and market rate units. It's a lot harder to finance them, but I think it's important for us to have a mixed income community that people can live and learn from each other in. So I know that was a long answer, but that's the tax credit in that shit.
Perfect explanation. Perfect explanations. AMI, is that area median income? Is that
correct?
That
correct? Area median income. So basically any area, let's take New Orleans metro. Mm-hmm. If you add up all of the incomes in the area and you add up all the people and divide it, no, that's the average. You take the middle person. You have all of these people up here, all these people down here. This person may make $74,000. Mm-hmm. Area median income may be $74,000.
Gotcha.
Let's use 100. Yeah. Let's use 100 for simple numbers. Let's say we're in DC and the AMI is 100. If the AMI is 100, the federal government also determined that anyone paying more than 30% of their wages towards housing is house burden, or there's an affordability problem.
Yeah.
So you have to pay lower than 30. That's ideal. So what they say is, okay, take someone that's making $100,000, right? And 30% of their income is $30,000, right? Divide that by 12, $2,500 is the most that they should be paying for housing on a monthly basis.
Yeah.
If that's the area median income, then most people can afford to pay $2,500, et cetera. You then take someone that's making $40,000 a year in the same exact area, they should not be paying $2,500 a month for rent.
Right.
$40,000, 30% of that is $12,000. Mm-hmm. That's $1,000 a month,
yeah.
Right? They should not be paying more than $1,000 a month.
Right.
The person that's paying $25 versus the person that's paying $100, is there a true and actual difference in what their housing should be?
No, I don't think so. Do you?
Absolutely not. You know, we shouldn't be sentenced to lower poverty or sentenced to like a crime almost, Egbert says this, for not having a certain income level, right? Yep. Yep. Most of the people that are making $100 probably were benefited in some way, shape, or form, right? Even though the false narrative of these folks, you know, being self-made, and these folks needing to pull themselves up by the bootstraps is just typically false. But broader point there is, these folks that are living in this side, when I said 1,000 versus 2,000, even if you're not living in this $1,000 area, you should be able to live in this $2,000 area, even if you can only afford $1,000. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the work that I do has actually been in market rate areas, and I've been putting affordable housing in those areas.
Right.
So people that can only afford to pay $1,000 can also live, work, and play in the areas that people typically pay $2,000 in.
Exactly. I love it. One of the things you talked about is mixed use. And earlier in the interview, you were talking about, you know, how the projects were built and concentrated poverty. We all know the downsides of it. Can you talk a bit more about the advantages of having mixed income in a development? You know, I personally believe it's very important and very beneficial, but, you know, as someone in the field, what are some of the benefits?
Yeah, I think just really proximity and understanding that we're closer to each other than we are far apart. Folks that may have been lower income may not have ever had an opportunity to connect with folks that have had more of an income, mm-hmm. and vice versa. And there's a lot of misconceptions and stereotypes, I think, that happen on both sides. But when they're cohabitating in a similar environment, inevitably there's going to be some shared experience, and mm-hmm. people will start to then overlap and realize, like, hey, no, one, if someone's making lower income, I then have the ability to make something higher. Mm-hmm. And or two, if someone's making a higher income, hey, I was on the same path as you, but you were hit with some unforeseen circumstance, and now I understand your story better. I think just sharing those stories, no different from what you're doing with your podcast, I think that improves lives all the way across the country. And I think you could do it through a medium like this or through physical placemaking of cohabitating people together.
Definitely. So what are some ways people can partner with the government and take advantage of programs for funding and things of that nature? I know, you know, just to the tax credits, you've done like a number of other partnerships, public-private partnerships. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think number one way is really just the land, mm-hmm. and people of color in particular looking at potential opportunities for development and investment with municipalities and getting low-cost, patient sellers, right? I think that's a huge opportunity. Another, it really just comes down to understanding what's out there. Like, there are many different tools, but unless you know this hammer hits that nail in, like, you shouldn't be trying to screw in something with a hammer. So I think it starts with education and learning, like, hey, how is this tool applicable to a certain thing?
Definitely.
There's a ton of programs, though.
Definitely. So what's your recommendation for someone who wants to get into development? They're interested in either affordable housing or mixed use, both of which you've done. What are 2 to 3 things they could do at the end of this interview to take the next step?
Probably find people in their area that are doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, first thing, feel free to follow me. I'm going to be creating more content and putting that stuff out. But that aside, I'm not a huge self-promoter. I would say, like, go when you're driving by different sites and there are cranes in the air and there's a fence. Typically, there are a lot of signs on it, on that fence. Reach out to every person on that sign. Find their LinkedIn. Have conversations with the contractor, the architect. Find people within the space. Go to the conferences that are local. Find your way to be in the room. Real estate is just relationship business. Commercial real estate even more so. Yeah. Find your way to get in the room, have the conversation, and create and provide value to them. Someone tells you something, listen, do it, circle back with whatever they told you to do before you go back to them. Don't come back to them with the same thing because you're wasting their time now.
Right.
But when you go back and you took their advice, they'll be more willing to help you get more into the space. And that's what separates like people that are serious versus people that are just talking.
Love it. A couple more before we wrap. So we talked a little bit on the way in the room. So a lot of people or developers sell or keep or a combination of things. So I would love to hear your take. What do you think people should do? Because, you know, I'm assuming it can be very tempting to sell. I mean, you can have a big payday versus keep the units for long-term income. So what's your stance?
I think it depends on your exit strategy. Like me, my long-term, most of my stuff I buy and I hold, or I develop and I hold. A lot of that has long-term compliance regulation around it from an affordability perspective. And I want to ensure like the people that I built this for can still maintain this thing that I created for, you know, on behalf of them. So I have been a buy and hold guy. I think there are some scenarios where you should sell as well, you know, especially if you're doing market rate development and the market is hot. Let that thing go. So I think it's more of a scenario based thing, but oftentimes you do, like even you said when we're walking in here, people sell and like kind of regret selling too early.
Yeah.
But it depends on your situation, your environment, and what your goals are.
Love it. So before we wrap, Brandon, talk about. Just a couple projects maybe you have in the pipeline, and then also where people can find you, where they can keep up with what you have going on.
Cool, yeah. So got some stuff in, doing a small condo conversion in D.C. My fiance and I are working on that, so that's pretty cool. It's a headache, but it's cool. I have two really large-scale projects in Birmingham, about 2,000 units between those two projects. Got some stuff in Atlanta, working on some studios, working on some multifamily, getting into some home ownership stuff as well. Then about 340 or so units in Houston as well. So that's the current pipeline. There's some more things kind of cooking, but you know, I think that's enough. And you can find me on all platforms, B_RULE. Brandon Rule is my name. Not really hard to find. Check out, I got this new like media company type of thing launching soon, where I'm creating a community for entrepreneurs, and we're going to be focused a lot on real estate and development. It's called The Rosa Group. Then I also have a real estate crowdfunding platform that I'm launching called Reinvest. Both of those will be out within the next few months. So check out B-Rule. You'll see everything I got going on.
We
got
to do a part two. It's a whole lot more to unpack.
Let's do it.
But Brandon, I appreciate you, man, taking this time to chat. You know, I think what I enjoy about your story is how relatable it is, you know, and I think it's just amazing that you're able to make an impact in your community where you're from. And now, you know, you're able to do a whole lot more all throughout the country and replicate the model you have. So I appreciate you, man. I know everyone will get a whole lot of value out of this interview.
Appreciate the time. Looking forward to watching it myself. And hopefully we inspire the next generation.
Absolutely. And thank you, everyone, for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast. Make sure you subscribe if you're on YouTube. Hit the like button. If you're on audio, leave us a 5-star rating and review. I look forward to hearing from you all soon. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast. Remember to follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue. And be sure to leave us 5 stars and a review on your favorite podcast listening platform. Until next time.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, Our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com.